This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
It's time for another episode of the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. I'm Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And this is kind of a different adventure for us. It really is an adventure because it's music that we both know pretty well and both have a high appreciation for. But not a lot of people do. Am I wrong there?
I don't know. I think in the years now, I think more people know and appreciate this band because Nine Inch Nails covered Dead Souls for The Crow. Someone take these dreams away that point me to another day. A jewel of personality, the strange or true reality.
They keep calling me. You think that really helped?
Yeah, I think it helps a lot. And I think the fact that the Killers also have covered Shadow Play and continue to do it live is a big deal to the younger people because they're listening to these songs and going, man, where did that come from?
To the center of the city where our roads meet, waiting for you. To the depths of the ocean where our hopes sink, searching for you.
There's a stark difference between the way each of these bands approaches this song. You know, you have the original, and then you have these younger kids who interpret it a lot differently, but see it through their eyes and through their pain. And pain is going to be a common theme throughout this conversation. Joy Division, a band that really looked at the emotions of the self hardcore. Remember, at this time period, it was 1974, 75, 76. The UK was a fucking mess. The 18 through 30 year old dudes were pissed off. They were drunk. They were fucking needing something. They couldn't get jobs. I mean, it was just a fucking messy time for the UK. And you had the bands that were punk, like the Sex Pistols, who were like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck
no
it all.
No future, fuck it all.
And then you had Ian Curtis and Joy Division who were like, wait, I'm fucked. I'm fucked up. And if you look at some of these old live videos and you look at some of the pictures, his eyes bared his soul hardcore. And when he was on stage, you could feel his anguish, his self not appreciation, his self dislike, his insecurity. You could feel all of that. And in some ways, many people related to it. And it was a whole new world of music, a whole new style, because in some ways, the music had this punk ethos, but the lyrics were anything but.
Right.
You fuck it all punk. It was completely the opposite.
And the emotions were not expressed the way punks were expressing them. On the first record, there's more of it because that is definitely different. And I want to put an idea out there that we can explore. But first, the sounds on that first record, more punk than what you would get in the future, even though the future doesn't last that long, right?
Yeah, it was very science fiction punk, and it was almost like you had these three instruments that were ambient and disjointed, but pulled together by Ian's vocal style.
And I don't think any of us playing it on the radio or following along at home thought that there was some kind of a problem with Ian, just that he had this strong anxiety in his voice, right? We didn't really know that there was something behind that that was darker.
Nobody knew that he had bipolar disorder and was suffering with a lot of mental health issues and anxiety and angst. And I mean, it's something that we'll continue to talk about throughout the episode, but it's only part of the story because the musicians in the band are also an important part of the story. They're the soundtrack to his pain.
Yeah.
If you watch the documentary, which we're going to talk about, Bernard Sumner says that he had a hard time listening to that debut Joy Division album because it was so heavy, so dark, and it was filled with so much pain. And the fact that it became a groundbreaker and such an important, influential album to him was mind-blowing, especially at the time. He was like, man, I don't know what you all see in it, man. It's so hard for me to listen to it. It's so heavy.
Don't you think, though, that a lot of great art that has some cataclysmic aspects to it often has that effect on the artist? They don't get why people are moved or touched by something, but that's it. People get it, no matter what you as the singer or the sculptor think.
Remember, all art has an element of politics to it, whether it be political politics, relationship politics, sexual politics, personal politics, societal politics, whatever. There is some sort of political aspect to art. And basically, Joy Division took the whole punk attitude and said, fuck you to the punks, and flipped it on its head.
I also find that being inspired to form the band by a Sex Pistols show, they're very sonically different, which we already talked about. Ironically, it's they who helped to start the post-punk movement, which puts the knife into the punk rock bands that think they can last more than a minute. And by the way, the Pistols maybe had that right. Maybe they were the ones that said, one and done and get what we can, you know, on the swindle. Because the bands that tried to go too long needed to change and develop, where some of the punks could just be like, one and done, motherfuckers. You know?
Absolutely. And we've heard it many times over the years. Lux Interior said it about the Cramps. He said, while political punk is great and all, people still at the end of the day want to dance. And you can only sing so many albums about how bad the system is. David Wakeling of the English Beat even acknowledged that as well and said, you know, here's our cheery dance number about Margaret Thatcher's awful employment policies for youth called Stand Down Margaret, you know? I mean, come on. Does that sound like a toe tapper? But it is. It's actually got a great groove because it's ska. So,
right. Oh, my. We're off and running on this episode talking about Joy Division. And by the way, Joy came first.
Yes.
Yes. Joy always comes first. But also, this is something else that happened, and it's probably the first crack in my disco wall. A lot of the music helped to erase the negative view of funk in a post-disco era. They were able to come along and reestablish those sounds. A lot of them created through keyboards, which were innovating left and right. Every year, there was a huge leap in keyboard development. But they kind of put the fun back in funk, even though there was a dark background in Joy Division's music.
At times, when you listen to their songs, the dance vibe is that awkward person dancing to the groove and, you know, that awkward kind of jerky moving. And we'll talk about it because when Joy Division would play live, often they opened up with Dead Souls because Dead Souls has a 3-minute intro and it gives a chance for Ian to get his brain wired correctly, as well as it gives a chance for the band to get into sync, which is a smart way to get your band going instead of sometimes jumping into it, which some bands feel more confident doing. He didn't, and he wanted it done this way, but it's a different kind of dance vibe. But again, alongside Susie Sue and the Banshees, they really ignited the post-punk scene. And then over in America, you had Blondie and the Talking Heads and some of those bands.
Happening all alongside punk or adjacent to it at the very least, right?
Oh, yeah. And you also had so much good rock at that time playing. So, I mean, the music scene was absolutely rich. You had the funk, you had the soul, you had the disco, you had the rock, you had the punk, you had the post-punk. Wow, what a time to be getting ear candy. Holy cow. we were lucky that so much great music was being produced at that time. And, you know, Joy Division, again, really flipped the music world hard because they really were the first to sing about those hardcore feelings inside and the self-doubt, the self-dislike, you know, the holy shit, this world is going downhill. We are screwed. I am screwed. I am a 22-year-old in the UK where it's hard to get a job, you know, what's going to happen? But there's so many factors involved here and the people could still feel it, but it still made you dance.
But first, you got to get all those people's attention. And they did that EP that came out in 78 called An Ideal for Living. I grew up not a change leg, but when the first time around, I could see all the weakness, I could pick all the faults, but I could see all the faces, just a stick in your throat. And that got them the attention of a local television host, Tony Wilson. Those kind of things seem to have more impact in America because of the BBC central nature of media, especially, you know, in those days. Now, it might not be as difficult for a young Joy Division to get out there, but that EP gets the attention of Tony Wilson and starts opening doors for the band and gets around to them working with Factory and him being a co-founder of that, right?
It's kind of wild because we did not go over their little history and how they came together, which they formed in Salford, Greater Manchester in 76 under the name Warsaw. It was originally Bernard Sumner, Peter Hook, and a drummer named Peter Mason. And they placed an ad in a Manchester record store and recruited Ian Curtis as their singer. Curtis knew them from a previous gig, and he too was at that Sex Pistols gig with his wife, Deborah Curtis. Richard Boone and Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks suggested they call themselves the Stiff Kittens. They rejected that name. In 1977, Mason quit as their drummer. He didn't have the confidence that he felt he needed to be their traveling recording drummer. So he became their manager, and he was replaced by a guy named Tony Tabak just before their gig opening for the Buzzcocks and Penetration at a place called the Electric Circus. They changed their name to Warsaw because the Buzzcocks thought it was funny to call them Stiff Kittens because they didn't have a name yet. So the Buzzcocks put Stiff Kittens on the bill, and they were like, hell no, we're not doing that. Five weeks later. I know, it's hilarious.
Well, you know, it makes you realize how close these guys all were in this era, that they were doing stuff like that or pulling for each other, or, yeah, we'll lend you our guitar player for the gig if you need him. You know, that kind of thing seemed to be more prevalent, and that's part of the recipe of cooking up any scene, I think.
Even though you're in competition for the label signing, the airplay, the money, you still will support each other because you never know when you might get a chance to. And one of these bands might do you a solid if they get a lead. And so you kind of got to look after each other. But after Tabak left, Steve Brotherdale joined the band. They recorded the Warsaw demo consisting of five songs, July 18th in 1977. Right after the demo, they fired Brotherdale and kind of did it in a total dickish way. They were driving and they were like, hey, man, check the tire. I think it's flat. He got out and they went,
no, they did not.
Yes, they did.
Who's the dick there? Yes.
I have no idea. Stephen Morris joined the band after responding to an ad in a music store window, and he mainly got the job because Ian remembered him from his academic days, and he fit in well with the rest of the band. And then in 1977, at the end of the year, they had to change their name to Joy Division because there was another band called Warsaw Pact at that time, and they wanted no confusion with them.
I did not know that that's why they felt they had to change their name. And so Joy Division is formed.
Even though it'd been together for a while and they did what a lot of bands in that time period did. They played a hell of a lot of live shows to work on their sound. And they all had jobs during the week. The band really developed their sound by playing a lot of live shows. And that is something that, you know, really matters. And when they went in to record, they wanted to record the live sound. They felt that that was the best way to capture Joy Division on record.
You know, that kind of runs counterintuitive to a lot of people who are in that musical sound neighborhood. You think they would like everything to be very up close and personal in a studio. But the scene, and this is how I think the whole thing graduated from punk into post-punk and everything afterwards, kind of forced you to get out there and do it live. And other bands too, like the Stone Roses, built themselves from the ground up as a live band before anybody wanted to talk to them about touring or recording on a wider level. The Happy Mondays come later, but it's the same kind of thing. It was just this full-blown, hey, here we are, right? But the Joy Division came from a dark place, Marcus. And I don't know how to explain it other than that. Well, let's take a quick look, because most people never heard of bipolar disorder back then. And most people didn't know that Curtis was suffering from that. We just heard a guy who was really putting it out there.
You know, mental health is no joke, and we've learned a lot since that decade of the 70s, the 60s, the post-World War II time. And thank goodness we have learned enough to be able to treat this form of neurodiversity individually, because each case is an individual case and each person reacts to each bit of medicine differently, each bit of therapy differently. What works for one person may not work for another person. So it's getting those, as we like to say, demons in control, but
the chemistry kit, and we're all different. That's the thing. And it's got to drive the chemists crazy, right? Because they're working so hard to help people, and sometimes you can't match up the things that people's brains need versus what you can give. Does that make sense?
How many people do we know that have had mental health issues that have required medicine to help balance the chemicals in their brain, that have had to have multiple different attempts at different medicines and different levels to make sure that the chemicals were balanced? We all know a few people that have had that, or at least one person that has been in that situation, or maybe we have. But mental health is, it's such a difficult issue. And if you watch the documentary on Joy Division, there were a couple of members of the bands who said they wish they could have done something. They wish they would have known more to do something back then, because they would have helped their friend. And they watched him change. He started having, you know, seizures, epileptic fits, and getting violent and just completely changing. And they, instead of fighting back when he was having a moment in the back of the car, they were getting punched and kicked, and they just pulled him out of the car and hung out with him and sat on him and held his arms and his legs down until he was able to end this fit or this moment and come back together. And, you know, that's what friends do. And they really cared about their friend very much, and they all cared about each other, and it was a hard time for them. They didn't know what to do.
Thinking in a way where you can put yourself in their position, then apply your own experience with people who suffer with some of these things that we know about. The amount of empathy alone that it took for the rest of the band members to say, no, Ian's our guy. We're going to make this work no matter what, right? We're the Joy Division. And they hung in there until he couldn't anymore. And another sad chapter in rock history.
The night after his suicide attempt, he went out there to play a gig, and he only did some of the songs because he was in no shape to perform. And according to the documentary, he felt like while he was on the stage watching them play, see, they can go on without me. They'll be better without me. They don't need me. I'm a holding them back, you know, and this is mental health, and this is self-doubt, and this is self-destruction, and this is all going on in his head, and the rest of the band had no idea at the time that this was happening on the side stage until later.
It's just numbing to think of the scenario like that and picture it in your mind. And we all have our moments where we're not feeling great, but I think it's hard for most of us to understand truly what someone that was suffering like Ian was suffering goes through on a daily basis sometimes, if not in fits and starts. It's unbelievable, no matter which it is.
Yes, it is, and it's tough. But we should talk a little bit about their music, too, because if you want to feel the pain of Ian Curtis, listen to some of their music. That original 7-inch of Shadow Play, you feel it. To the center of the city where a road's being made for you. Think about this. Here's Shadowplay. To the center of the city where all roads meet, waiting for you. To the depths of the ocean where all hope sank, searching for you. I was moving through the silence without motion, waiting for you. Right there, you know that song is sad and heavy. And listen to Digital. I feel it closing in. Everything's closing in. The heaviness, the entrapment you feel when listening to that song. Again, it makes sense why that album was hard for Bernard Sumner to listen to after they recorded it, because, man, it's not easy to listen to it. I recommend you listen to Unknown Pleasures all the way through. It starts with Disorder, Day of the Lord's Candidate, Insight, New Dawn Fades, She Lost Control, Shadowplay, Wilderness, Interzone, I Remember Nothing. That's some heavy, heavy, dark music. And it's hard to listen to all the way through.
If you really want to understand it, I think you just made the best case for it. Listen all the way through. That album kind of puts it all in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
It's hard to listen to. And then, you know, the next album, they released two albums post-mortem. Closer really was the only other album. Everything else after Closer was like remixes and demo versions and live shows and things like that. So the first two albums, Unknown Pleasures and Closer, pretty heavy and dark. I mean, Atrocity Exhibition, Isolation, Passover Colony, A Means to an End, Heart and Soul, 24 Hours, The Eternal, and Decades. Listen to those all the way through, and I'm telling you, you will feel it too. Did it many times in the 80s, sometimes with friends, but we listened to a lot of this music in high school, and it really impacted us. The first album I ever listened to was still by Joy Division, and my favorite song on that one is Ice Age, and it's pretty dark, and it's pretty bleak as well.
This is where I feel like I have to remind people that if you're struggling, whether it's the way that Ian did or just the way that you are struggling, 988 in the United States can get you a listening, helpful ear anytime, anywhere you are. And if you add a 1 at the end, 988, and then dial 1, if you're a veteran, that takes you right to a counselor who will help you specifically. Mental health inside music and inside the heads of the music fans, all important to all of us here at Dark Doc Media, 988. Well, after this conversation, I need a pint. Kind of get me stoked for part two, New Order, when the band survives the passing of their leader.
That's what's next on the imbalanced history of rock and roll.
Well, Marcus, the seasons are changing and the board is changing at Crooked Eye, because you know what happens. You always have your standards there on the left side. If you look at it on social media, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, their pictures lay it out very clearly for you, what they've got. So
keep your eye on that, sure. But on the right side of the board, that's where the spring ales and the new stuff that Jeff's been working on starts coming out and making its way into your glass. Right there at the bar at Crooked Eye Brewery in the heart of Hapro, pouring the cure for over 10 years now, just celebrating their 10th anniversary. The party's still going on over there. You know that, man, right?
The party never stops at Crooked Eye with live music, great entertainment, with just things happening at Crooked Eye, the great beers, the great drinks. It never stops.
And get that Salty Vets barbecue on select nights. You can find out about everything going on at Crooked Eye Brewery on their Facebook and other social media accounts. And thanks to them always for sponsoring us here on the podcast. Always a friend to be made when you make a Crooked Eye. Marcus, we've talked about the challenges that Ian Curtis was facing emotionally and his first attempt at suicide. Sadly, he succeeded, leaving Joy Division and everyone around him kind of feeling numb, but also in the lurch.
The band still to this day has not recovered fully from it because there's still so many unanswered questions. Deborah Curtis wrote a memoir called Touching from a Distance, which is pretty intense if you want to read a little bit about their relationship and her view of the music industry as the wife of Ian Curtis. It's pretty intense, and I recommend you check it out, especially if you're a fan of the band. And their name actually came from the Holocaust. In the Auschwitz concentration camp, the Jewish female prisoners that were called the Joy Division for the Nazis that used to rape them. The name came from a book called House of Dolls by a Holocaust survivor named Kat Setnik. And this was written in 1955. And in that book, she spoke of the Joy Division. And so they took their name from that when they had changed their name from Warsaw, which was influenced by the David Bowie song of the same name, because right. Ian was hoping that he could have that charisma and that style that he and Mark Bolan and Iggy Pop all had. That
this is the backdrop of his struggle, right?
It's one of the backdrops of his struggle. I mean, being in post-World War II Manchester as the town died industrially and everybody moved out and there was so much misery and poverty in that area, that added to it too. He had a civil servant job. He was married. He had a new baby. He was having an affair. So it was kind of a mess, but his final days were pretty interesting because on May 20th, he was supposed to, with the band, head over for their first American tour, and the band was thrilled that they were going to get a chance to play on the other side of the pond. So, and thanks to Far Out Magazine, I was able to get the final few days of Ian Curtis as much information as they had on a timeline. And again, they were leaving for the U.S. tour May 20th. On Thursday, May 17th, 1980, there was a reconciling phone call after a period of living estranged from his wife, Deborah, and infant daughter, Natalie, following his supposed affair with Anik Honoré and worsening medical condition, his bipolar getting worse. Curtis contacts his wife and asks her to drop her impending divorce proceedings. However, his mood swings are frequent and she is doubtful that he really means it. A sudden change of heart. Later that day, Deborah visits Ian at their former marital home on 77 Barton Street in McClesfield, as per her suggestion to him on the phone that she would spend the night with him. However, when she arrives, his demeanor has changed, and he now says he wants to spend the night alone. Thursday night of May 17th, Curtis reportedly watched the Werner Herzog film Strosek, the movie documenting the tale of an aspiring German musician hoping for a better life in Wisconsin. The musician eventually moves to America only to end up committing suicide after he is betrayed by his girlfriend. With Curtis fearing his own impending tour to America, there is dark symmetry to this tale.
Wow.
The looming tour again, they're going to embark upon on May 20th. Little has been made of the fact that a few months earlier, Curtis attempted suicide by pills. Bernard Sumner recalls walking through a graveyard and telling his friend that he doesn't want to end up just like a headstone. And Curtis replying, right, yeah, right. No connection in his response, that real distant response that we've seen in people.
Mm-hmm.
Friday, May 18th, 1980, an intoxicating lifestyle. Thereafter, Curtis begins drinking coffee and spirits. High levels of caffeine and whiskey would be found in his body when the autopsy was later conducted. Both substances were not great for his condition and medication. It is a tragic contrast that the manic life of rock and roll that ran contrary to the medical advice that he had received. The last record. Curtis proceeds to listen to Iggy Pop's The Idiot on the record is the song Tiny Girl, a track that starts with the line, "Well, the day begins, you don't want to live because you can't believe in the one you're with." The album is also inspired by Fyodor Dostoevsky's book of the same name about an epileptic prince whose good-hearted nature leads to mockery in a cruel and unforgiving world, which eventually drives him mad. Friday, May 18th, the tragic end. Curtis removes his wedding photos and pictures of his daughter from the walls, lays them out before him as he constructs a note. The note apparently speaks of his love for Deborah despite his recent behaviors. She later finds this note in Curtis hanging from the kitchen washing line.
Wow. It's just stunning to me, really.
It is. It's an intense story. The music's intense. Love will tear us apart. Listen to the lyrics, and it kind of goes along with this story here. A sad tale.
Because I want to talk about the 24-hour Party People documentary. It's kind of a lo-fi tribute, but thank goodness they made it because we can learn so much, even though some of it is reenacted, let's just say that, like Steve Coogan's parts, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely a fictionalized, sensationalized account of the story. There's also a documentary about Joy Division on Tubi, which you can watch with commercials. And
what's it called?
Joy Division.
Oh, easy to find. Let's talk about the docu. Kind of shows where they all were when they saw the Pistols live. You know, that thing you were talking about, this one's over here. They actually show you in there and like, you know, put a like, we think he was over here. Here's a picture we found of him in the house, right? Buzzcocks were there. Howard Pete's there. Mick Hucknall apparently was there that night, same as the Joy Division guys.
You know, a lot of people from that Manchester scene were there. And again, there's probably 100, 140 people in the crowd, and we probably know the names just from the music world of 40 of them, you know, whether they be in producers, whether they be record people, whether they be band people like the guys from Joy Division, New Order, the Buzzcocks, Cabaret Voltaire, some of the other bands that were from that area starting to develop and grow at that time.
I wasn't surprised when Moby showed up during the documentary talking about both bands, especially Joy Division, as an influence on him, calling them the link between Kraftwerk and the Chemical Brothers. And it makes so much sense when one of the guys who does this stuff says that. It just kind of puts the light bulb on over the rest of our heads, right?
And they're a band who ignited change in that scene and what they did, and then what New Order did. If you look a decade later, you had Mother Love Bone, and then you had Pearl Jam, and that kind of ignited a scene as well, or changed a scene.
There aren't too many cases where something like this happens and there's anything worthwhile coming out the other end. And New Order, in my mind, and maybe it's because they had so much more time to work at it, ends up delivering many more memorable songs and albums. Along the way, they made a lot of mistakes. The whole thing over Blue Monday and the record label at Factory, they did some creative accounting. It's probably the best way to look at it. But the way they did Blue Monday is one of the examples where the cost of that single, whether it was whatever it took to make the video and the special production aspects, these kind of things, I think somewhere in the documentary, one of them says they made a lot of bad business decisions. And that leads to not recouping and not getting paid and a lot of financial fiascos, right? including fines from the government for doing things that they didn't know they weren't allowed to do. So they've been paying off a fine that took 8 years, as well as all these other mistakes they made. Boardroom mayhem ensues. Overhead excesses are shown, where in one moment they're talking about making your next record on a more reasonable budget, and then he's like, yeah, but they're going to send the Happy Mondays off to Mallorca to record. Stuff like that. And the thing I couldn't believe actually stood up to any lawyers anywhere is that there was a contract written in blood that is actually shown in the documentary. My God. Crazy is writing a contract on the back of a napkin and trying to enforce it. To write it in blood. Were there any lawyers in that room, Marcus? I mean, really? Aside from the scene and showing a part of it and the music and showing a part of it, the whole thing ends up being a cautionary tale, in a manner of speaking, maybe telling you as much what not to do. But the mad scramble to new order happens, keeping it largely within the family, right? Adding Jillian Gilbert.
Yep, he added the keyboards, but they started really experimenting with electronic sound a lot more. And they released that very first single, Ceremony, at the very beginning. So successful, but it also wasn't too bad, and it really kind of got the ball rolling for them, because they originally released 8 singles without an album as New Order before they released the album Low Life, and then released the single Perfect Kiss off of it, which is a great song, by the way.
Wait a minute. I got to ask you something before you go any further. Did they release all those singles because that's what they wanted to do artistically, because they didn't feel like they all worked together as an album, or was there something else?
I don't know. My guess would be that there was probably some sort of label holdup, or probably trying to work out labels and working out record deals, which may have taken a while, because they're like, wait a minute, Ian Curtis, man, he was about ready to blow them up. And those first couple of singles, while they did well on the indie charts, 34, 38, not charting, 29, until 83 when they released Blue Monday, which hit number 9 in the UK. And by the way, Blue Monday, that original recording is awesome. Just fantastic.
Like I said earlier, they gave us so much more music than their predecessor. And all through the 80s, with that one gap we were talking about from 89 to 93, they kind of took some time off, but active all the way through. And it isn't one of those scenarios, Marcus. Often we talk about the what-if scenario. And I don't really know that, given his frailties, that Curtis would have lasted through all these changes, all the different musical changes that would come. I mean, when you listen to those first couple records, then listen to Technique, there's definitely something different in the musical approach. They're working with the times, not trying to set the times, not trying to keep up with the times. They're just kind of flowing with it. And I think that's why they lasted so long. As much as anything, they're a great band, and they kept it going. And I think that those elements really contributed to that.
And And remember how much technology was changing at that time as we were moving from analog to digital?
Oh, yeah.
The synthesizer sounds, the synthesizer beats, the electronic drums were being taken to a whole new level, and it was allowing them to create new sounds. They decided, we're not going to become dinosaurs and go extinct. We're going to move. We're going to change with all of this technology. This is so much fun to learn. And they enjoyed it, and they made great music continuously.
Now, by the time they figured all that out, I was already out of my college radio days. But you were a little bit younger, and you got to experience this in, like, generation one of consumption, right? This was your thing.
Oh, absolutely. High school and college. And I can't tell you how many clubs I went to in the 80s where these songs were played to dance to, whether it even be something like Love Will Tear Us Apart or something like Bizarre Love Triangle or Perfect Kiss or, you know, Blue Monday even. They had like 7 or 8 remixes of Blue Monday throughout the 80s that would show up, and even DJs would attempt to remix them and test them on the dance floor at that time. And it was a great time for that type of, dancing. Not a good dancer, but boy, it was fun.
I want to put something out there I've been thinking about. When Joy Division starts, there was really nothing they would call the old romantics, even though those bands that are currently referred to that did exist, like Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, like we were discussing. But from the beginning of Joy Division, somewhere in there, they're part of this growing new sound, new movement, if you will, of musicians, using that technology that we're talking about, crafting it to sound the way they want it to sound. And musicians, going back to Bach and Beethoven, probably had sounds in their heads that they couldn't get out because of the limitations of the instrument, not their brains. And now the instruments were keeping up with imaginations. And I just think that all was like a confluence. The right talent and the right mentality and the old school influence on the new romantics to launch this whole thing, which was a monstrous part of the 1980s.
Oh, yeah. The 80s and the new romantic music, huge. Joy Division, ain't nothing new romantic about them at all. This is not the kind of romance I want to be involved in. This is a serious look at mental health and feelings about oneself. And the new romantic scene, totally different. But like you said, Joy Division, Bauhaus, Susie and the Banshees, the Stranglers, all were involved in helping shape that sound. And if you listen to Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, some of the biggies in that new romantic sound, The Cure as well. But if you listen to the early Cure, they sound a lot like Joy Division in those days too, because The Cure was onto something a little different, punky, but not so punky. And if you listen to a lot of that Motown soul vibe mixed in with that new romantic sound, that punky sound that softened it up and kind of gave it that love vibe.
We're into the love vibe portion of the program on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll, but that's kind of the vibe from the new romantics in the 80s. They were the backdrop or the soundtrack for a lot of the love that was going on out there in the clubs. And I don't mean, you know, groping in the corner. I mean people falling in love to that music.
Oh, yeah, that was some sexy music. Duran Duran, Spandau Ballet, some sexy music. Movies like Valley Girl came out of that in the 80s. And some of the other Pretty in Pink, Psychedelic Furs, some of those bands all came out of that whole scene. So, yeah, good time for music. You had the excess and the decadence of the 80s rock. You had the speed metal brewing. You had the death metal. You had the punk. You had the hardcore punk coming out of the punk. It was crazy.
And in the middle of all that, you've got a dude with a coif and 2 keyboards setting the entire dance floor on fire. It was an interesting time to experience. I'll just say that because of all the different things that were going into the stew that was rock and roll history of the 80s. It's a complex recipe, and we're just exploring really one little portion of it here. These guys from Manchester, a little bit about the other people from Manchester and the background. Right? The factory record scene, the Hacienda, And through all of this, the Factory, Factory Records, the other big club that was attached to all this, the place where they would experiment and try everything, the Hacienda, this is the scene. This is where a lot of people met a lot of other people and shared music together. And these two bands that were pretty much the same people except for one person really was central to all the stuff that was happening there. And people would come and go, as you pointed out later. But I gotta tell you, man, a hell of an impact for a small squad, if you will.
Definitely, and their light shined bright as Joy Division, unfortunately, for a very short time. I personally don't think Ian Curtis would have enjoyed the rigorous life of banding and being in a band, and I think it would have been too much for him no matter what. I think his plan of doing that original American tour for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, was what he thought that he could handle mentally. And then, of course, never made it because he completed suicide.
And the hardest part for you or me or any other fan is really understanding. I think we mistakenly feel like we're giving all the love we have to the artist we love. And people don't understand why that's not enough. And sometimes the answer is, it just isn't. There are hard things that people deal with. Show some love and compassion. It helps.
And we never know what's happening in their lives as well.
Right.
We never know what's happening in anybody else's life or behind their walls. So
I suggest you go deep on New Order, that is, because there's all kinds of stuff that comes out down the line, like the John Peel sessions and the Best of One and the Rest of One and Before and After the BBCs. And just go dig in, dive in, like you mean it, right? There's even a WEA compilation on Rhino, Total, from Joy Division and New Order. Maybe start there if you really want to dig all the way in. Definitely looking for your input on this one, especially if, say, you were in Manchester in this time period and you experienced a lot of this firsthand. Definitely send us an email at imbalancedhistory@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on any of these social media platforms under the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. And if you experienced it, we need to hear about it. This was such an exciting time for music and such a crazy time for youth. And the fact that that cocktail was stirring and brewing and getting ready to explode was so important. And so if you were part of that, please share your stories. And again, if we missed anything in the timeline or forgot anything or left anything out, please let us know via email or any other social media platform. Thank you.
We're on the Pantheon Podcast Network, a product of Dark Duck Media. Thanks to our sponsor, Crooked Eye Brewery, in the heart of Hapro since 2014, pouring the cure for what ails you. Signing off, I'm Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And this has been From Joy Division to New Order on the Imbalanced History
of Rock and Roll.